This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
This programming is sponsored by Linscomb Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at LinscombWealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us and hearing us talk a little politics for the next 25 or so minutes.
Wow, that's pressure deadline. Right?
I know. And every moment we are trying to stretch that to get as close to 30 as possible. We know the public wants more, and
so we're
trying to give it to you.
The demand is high.
Exactly. Well, Brandon, we have had a really quiet week. Nothing has happened.
That's good. We had to struggle to find something to talk about.
I know. Well, you know what? Let's start with one of the stories that has just been blowing up the news and internet, which is Michael Mickey Cohen, the president's consigliere, a personal lawyer, had himself visited by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It looks like Russiagate is heating up. They went after Mickey Cohen, got a warrant, came in. Big news, or is this just kind of more of the drip?
I think it's moderately big news. I mean, obviously, it's never a good sign when your lawyer's office is raided by the FBI. So that's like one point to start with. But it suggests to me a couple things. I mean, first of all, obviously, this doesn't mean he's guilty or that the president is guilty. But I think what it does mean, and check me if I'm wrong on this, that the FBI believes he won't cooperate. And so they're trying to get this before they can have any kind of potential evidence smearing. So I think that's one thing to note. To me, it suggests also that no one's above the law, right? The saying here in Texas is there's never been a horse that can't be rode or a cowboy that can't be thrown. So even if you're the president's attorney, you still are on the hook for things that you do and say. And part of the reason that he got this raid was that he had essentially bragged that he had paid off some of these individuals who had affairs with President Trump. And so the fact that this was all out there, you know, clearly gets the attention of the FBI, and this is the result.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting aspects to this. Number one, it's really rare for private attorneys to be raided this way, mm-hmm. because there is, I think, as the president discussed, attorney-client privilege. Mm-hmm. So to overcome attorney-client privilege is a massive step. This was not Robert Mueller raiding Mickey Cohen. This was the FBI. It had to be signed off by the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, which is a Trump appointee. Had to be signed off by the Assistant Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, both of which are Trump appointees. And so there was a very high burden. It's something that you don't normally see, but it speaks to what we said, Brandon, which is that there's something clearly there, allegations of payoffs. We don't know where the money came from, what the president knew. And his reaction, I think, is indicative that he recognizes that we're entering kind of a new phase. And this is pretty serious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of Nixon's attorney during Watergate, Herb Klumbach, right, who was the bribe and hush money delivery guy. He was also the subject of an FBI investigation and ended up going to jail. So it has happened, and not that we're drawing parallels to Watergate exactly, but it's clear that this is pretty important. So I think you're exactly right about that.
Well, look, shifting gears a little bit, the international scene continues to be really at a crisis level. Syria is continuing to be a problem. The Syrian civil war has sort of entered again a new stage. We thought things were starting to wind down. It is now alleged that the Syrian government used chemical weapons against its own people.
Again,
after previously being warned not to. There has been global condemnation, and now we are seeing the president tweeting out, be prepared for missile strikes. Mm-hmm. But then he sort of corrected himself and says, maybe, maybe not. Mm-hmm. So we're not quite sure what's going to happen, but we know that there are significant plans being drawn up for military intervention of some form as it relates to Syria.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about Russia as being a domestic problem here in the U.S., but the fact is that the battlefront with Russia is in Syria, and that's something the president's going to have to confront. So one issue when the president reasserts or reconstructs the foreign policy towards Syria will be how will they handle the Russian issue, because this is now the sphere of influence that these groups are fighting over. So I do think that this is the moment where they have to think about what they want to do. The president, not weeks ago, said he wanted to draw down troops in Syria. He's also said before that that he wasn't so sure that Assad was the big problem, right? And he had kind of cast this as being not that important. Well, I think we have seen, and his tweets make clear, that now he sees how important this is and how dramatic this can be and the kind of loss of life associated with it. So I don't know what the president will do here. I mean, he said he doesn't want to telegraph, right, which he sort of did, right, that he was going to act. He also accused President Obama of not acting when he put down a red line about the use of chemical weapons. So in some ways, he has to act in order to be consistent. So I think the Syria issue is still a mess. They need to figure out what they want to do, and then they can figure out what strategic choices they can make.
Yeah, I think the real problem is they're not quite sure what they can do to make the situation better. The Russians, I think, have been pushing back. And again, this sort of shows that there's an interconnectedness with, as it relates to Russia.
Yeah.
How we deal with them domestically, how we deal with them internationally, they're all interconnected. And that's one of the reasons why people have often asked, why do we care so much about the Russian investigation? Why does it matter? In large part because they are both a major adversary for us globally, or at least they are someone that we have to be aware of globally because they are involved in so many other things.
And too, Jay, this is John Bolton's first week as National Security Advisor, and he is hawkish, you know, beyond what we've seen before. So we could see a much more aggressive foreign policy here on Syria, which is their first big moment to shine.
Well, Brandon, I want to shift gears entirely. We've had sort of two interesting and serious discussions, but we've had congressmen do crazy things in the past.
Congress, really?
Exactly. I know. But U.S. Congressman Ralph Norman from South Carolina, sitting at a diner, meeting with a bunch of constituents, many of whom were gun control advocates, decided to prove a point. What did he do?
Well, so he apparently, in an effort to suggest that firearms are not dangerous, pulled a gun during this meeting and laid it on the table, didn't use it in a threatening manner, but suggested that this is like a perfectly legitimate and not unsafe thing to do. So,
was he making an offer they couldn't refuse? Is that what it was?
Did he get it from behind the toilet, right? Godfather style?
Exactly, right? He left the gun and he took the cannoli.
It's really hard to imagine like what he's thinking at that. It apparently it is also against the law in South Carolina to point or present a firearm at another person. So I don't know how you would classify this. It's obviously not good PR. It's not good community relations. So I don't exactly understand this, but I think that this is the kind of culture around guns that is now present, right? You have people who say everyone should have a gun, and then you have people who say that no one should have a gun. And it's hard to see what the middle ground looks like, especially when these kinds of things happen.
Well, those kinds of silly actions are not limited to members of Congress. Here in Texas, Brandon, our good friend, the Texas Agriculture Commissioner, Sid Miller, he's once again found himself in a little hot water. So what happened here?
It is like a B movie, Jay. So our own Texas Ag Commissioner, Sid Miller, has appointed to the state's Rural Health Task Force a former physician named Ray Redlin. Dr. Redlin's medical license was suspended when he was convicted of perjury in a case involving his marriage to his 15-year-old stepdaughter. I did not say that incorrectly, Jay. His marriage to his 15-year-old stepdaughter. His license was eventually revoked for good after he failed to report a medical malpractice suit. He also has donated heavily to the Miller campaign, leading people to ask whether or not this is pay to play.
That's right. He bills himself, Rick Ray Redlin, as sort of the maverick doctor. He owns a telemedicine company, and this is a rural health task force. He's using it as a means to sort of promote telemedicine as an alternative to for expansion of healthcare. But yeah, this is one of those classic Sid Millerisms. I mean, I'm not sure how anyone could think this is a good idea other than Sid Miller. Even if he didn't lose his medical license for essentially marrying a child, this is someone who contributed heavily to this campaign.
Yeah, almost $90,000.
Yeah, just before this.
Right. And this is actually gives a sense of how chaotic the first weeks and year was of the Miller administration. This came early, and so maybe they didn't vet properly, but there's no excuse for it. This actually occurred to me when I was looking at this, an old expression from Texas, and that is, if dumb was dirt, this would cover about 3 acres.
Indeed. Indeed. Did you just call Sid Miller dirt?
The decision.
Oh, the decision. The decision.
If Dumb was dirt, the decision would cover about 3 acres. I think he would appreciate that, though, right?
Yes, he would. He would. Well, Brandon, we've just gotten back the national reports on the state of schools, the national assessment exam called NAEP that's administered, and it does these 2-year snapshots of fourth graders and eighth graders looking at their performance in reading and mathematics kind of across. And it's a way to compare different states. It's a way to compare sort of different cohorts of kids. Texas and the nation are not doing very well. What happened? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so compared to the national average, Texas is a smaller percentage of kids who are considered reading proficient, and also we're kind of generally a higher percentage of students below a basic achievement in reading. This is your area of expertise, Jay. Does this suggest that high-stakes testing isn't working? Does it mean we need to fast-forward issues in terms of accountability, like the A to F scale that's coming? What's going on here?
Well, if you look at the results, they tell us two things. One, the only state that actually saw growth was Florida.
Huh.
They implemented A through F, and they're actually sort of moving in the right direction. Now, part of it is the baseline.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard with these tests because it tests fourth and eighth grade kids, but it's a different set of kids.
Oh, yes.
And so some of it is a demographic change in the state. So we know that Texas as a whole, in some ways, is getting more diverse. It's getting more poor as well. We've got lower income kids now because of lack of investments in the state in terms of public education. So what we're seeing is the gap between performance of upper income kids and Anglo kids continues to be a persistent spread.
Mm-hmm.
We're not doing a particularly good job with African-American and Latino kids, and that's the future of Texas,
yes,
particularly Latino kids. And so it's imperative that we invest more. All at the same time, Texas is sort of moving in the wrong direction on this. So we're flatlined, we're mirroring what's going on nationally, but we need to invest more. And that's kind of the big takeaway.
Yeah.
Texas schools are in trouble and need some help. And so hopefully this will be a wake-up call.
Hey, maybe the internet can help, right? Let's ask Mark Zuckerberg, right?
Exactly.
Well, he was in front of Congress mostly talking about safety and security of Facebook and the implications for Facebook's involvement in politics. What did he say, and what struck you as interesting about this?
Right. Well, the hearings, he had 2 days of hearings, one in the Senate, then in the House, and they were purported to be about the illegal transfer of data that Cambridge Analytica had done, purchasing from a third party and then using that data to essentially develop sort of political strategy for candidates. And unfortunately for Mark Zuckerberg, or fortunately, depending on your perspective, he spent a good part of the hearing, particularly on the first day with the Senate, explaining what Facebook is and does.
Right.
Right. So one of the issues and one of the criticisms was during this is that it seemed clear that many of the senators simply didn't know that much about sort of the actual workings of Facebook.
Was it Orrin Hatch who asked him, like, how do you make money if you don't, like, charge people
to join? Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, like, I'm not sure. I mean, just sort of obvious
basic
things,
stuff,
right?
Yeah. One big thing for Ted Cruz was a question about political bias, right?
Right, in fact, for Cruz, that was interesting because he just shifted gears dramatically, and we saw on the next day that became a major Republican talking point. So Facebook famously is, and Mark Zuckerberg himself is sort of viewed as kind of a liberal or progressive person. There had been allegations of censorship. And here's the catch. Ted Cruz didn't want to talk about Cambridge Analytica for a whole variety of reasons, not the least of which he was their first client. So he was never going to say a word about Cambridge Analytica, but he shifted gears and put Facebook on, not so much for sharing data, but being politically biased.
Yeah. I mean, this is a sellable argument for Cruz. I mean, it's unclear like what the resolution would be. I mean, Zuckerberg implied that they're a neutral platform. And, you know, Cruz implied that they had done things like suppress conservative stories about CPAC and Mitt Romney and shut down things like the Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day. So that interaction was pretty telling in terms of the politics of this. And if it's the case that the Facebook becomes politicized in that way, it's going to be difficult for them, I think, to be able to maintain the kind of connection that they need, but also potentially lose some support from Congress, which they need to be able to keep that independent status.
Yeah, I viewed it almost entirely as just kind of a straw man talking point that Senator Cruz wanted to put up, largely because I can go right now and spend a lot of time on Ted Cruz's Facebook page.
Yeah.
And there's lots of political content among conservatives. There's lots of political content among extremist groups that continue to exist on Facebook. Well, so I'm not sure it's a real argument. There were sort of isolated incidences, and I get it from Cruz's perspective.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to talk about Cambridge Analytica
right.
because he benefited from it.
Right.
So talking about shared data and looking and analyzing data doesn't really is not in his wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Because for him, it just shines a spotlight on him.
That's right.
He had 2 to 3 minutes. He wanted to prove a point, and he wanted to attack Facebook from a political and partisan perspective because, lo and behold, he's running against Mr. Facebook in Beto O'Rourke, who's raised all this money out of small-dollar contributions using social media. So I think it's much more about politics than actual substance.
That's a great point. Well, speaking of politics, we have a pretty high-profile resignation here at the end of down south, right, in Corpus Christi. Blake Farenthold has decided, after all this, to resign. What happened? Why?
Well, the reality is that he had numerous allegations of misconduct, of inappropriate behavior with staff members over months. And he'd already made a decision that he wasn't going to run for re-election. And that eventually turned into just a complete resignation.
Yep.
And so part of the issue, I think, is the process around that. I mean, this becomes, I think, number 31 or 30, Brandon, in terms of
38.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I've been underselling it.
Yes.
Number 38, which is a record for Republicans. I think the next highest was during the 1930 election.
And a record for Texas, too.
Yes, and a record for Texas. So we're seeing massive turnover. Again, you're going to have a special election mm-hmm. that's going to determine it. The governor's going to have to call it, mm-hmm. I guess,
yeah.
Pretty quickly if he's going to, or is he going to try to do it in November? And if he does that, what's going to happen? Is that district even in play, Brandon?
Well, I think it's potentially in play. I mean, the Representative Farenthold said that he would pay back the $84,000 used to settle this complaint that basically the government paid. Lots of organizations have said that he should pay it back, including the National Republican Campaign Committee. So I think if it's the case that that position doesn't get changed and there's a lingering doubt about the Republicans' ability to hold the seat, then it could be that the Democrats get some traction. Beck Braun has raised a fairly good sum of money. He outspent his opponent 2-1 in that. So he's probably going to be the winner, but there's still a runoff. So he presents a pretty formidable challenge to a Democrat, but it's an open seat, so lots can happen. You've also have a potential blue wave, right, and lots of anti-Trump fervor that might be able to overcome this. Scandals that take place in districts oftentimes cost the incumbent about 7%. So if it's the case that this is a district that gets a 7% hit, then it could be the Democrats are in a slightly better shape. But this is a Republican seat, Jay, right? It's pretty well drawn to support a Republican incumbent. So it's going to take a lot for the Democrats to win it.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And on that topic of resignation, we're going to talk about the bombshell resignation that just took place with Speaker Ryan not resigning, but retiring, and talk about the implications and what that's going to mean for the U.S. House.
So, Jay, the big news of the week, if you can believe it, in addition to all the other big news, is that Speaker Ryan is stepping aside. He is the fittest speaker since Joe Cannon. If you are not aware, please go Google search Paul Ryan, P90X, and you will see how fit he is. Speaker Joe Cannon, Jay, it was said, could lift a bus over his head back in the 1900s. So, like, it's a long legacy of very fit speakers. But
Newt Gingrich notwithstanding.
Newt Gingrich does not count. This is important news, Jay, right? This creates a pretty serious power vacuum heading into a pretty difficult election. So what's our take on this, and what are the implications for Congress and for the party?
If you believe Speaker Ryan, it's that he wants to spend time with his family. He's 48 years old. I mean, he's been in Congress since he was in his late 20s. He was elected in 1999. I mean, he's had kind of a meteoric rise. And even prior to that, he was a staffer for Jack Kemp. And so he's been there and been a Washington creature for a very long time, even though he builds himself as a bit of an outsider. And so it's a big change. No one saw it coming, both among Republicans, certainly not Democrats. But I also think there's sort of underlying issues here. We know that his brand of Republicanism, that traditional sort of free market conservatism embodied by folks like Jack Kemp, kind of comes out of that libertarian school of thought, the Ayn Rand school of thought that he is a big proponent of. is essentially not in vogue anymore. This is Donald Trump's Republican Party, much more nationalistic, much less open to free trade. And so you've got real problems here. And so I think he saw that. And so I think this sets up a couple things. One, for him, he's going to lay back. He's no longer going to be held responsible for what's going on with Trump. If he loses the speakership and Democrats pick up 26, 27 seats, which increasingly looks like a real possibility, he would be the minority leader and have to sit there and essentially watch potentially as a president continues to sort of unravel. It just now frees him up to be an outsider, potentially wage a campaign in 2020, or just essentially sort of recalibrate. But it speaks, I think, to the larger politics, not just in Washington, but also nationally.
Yeah, and that's the problem. You know, the Republicans do not want it to speak to anything beyond this because the optics are really important here. It looks like the captain is going down with the ship, and that's something that may stimulate further retirements and leave the politics of the midterm essentially like a lost cause. And that's a real problem for the party. He was a huge unifying force for the party, right? They begged him to be speaker, and only after, you know, weeks of badgering did he agree. But what he wanted to do in Congress, like reforming entitlements, you said he was a Jack Kemp acolyte, and that's exactly what he wanted to do in Congress. That's not what the party wants to do now, right? They're in a very different direction. So he is not, I think, built to be a speaker for the long term, and that's one problem. His priorities didn't match, and the DOP is going to have to figure out where the new leadership will come from, right? Well, who's going to unify the party?
And exactly.
Who's going to raise the money? Speaker Ryan was here in Texas, not but 2 weeks ago, and he raised $4 million. Well, who's going to be able to raise that much money? Who has the high enough profile to be able to get the party's coffers filled up for what's going to be a pretty tough election? I don't think we know.
Well, I mean, look, this is the second Republican speaker that sort of resigned this way, sort of fed up with the system. I mean, his predecessor, John Boehner, who just, interestingly enough, decided to join a cannabis company, sort of switching from Marlboro Reds to Mary Jane, so to speak. But I mean, this follows in that tradition, right? The Republican Party, as much as we think of it as having a set of core principles, is really a coalition party now, much in the same way the Democrats are. He struggled to keep the Freedom Caucus with more moderate Republicans, and now there's sort of these Trump Republicans in there, and then dealing with a White House and a Senate that everyone was on a different page, even though they were all from one party. So from the speaker's perspective, from Ryan's perspective, this was a hard, hard thing to do. And I think he was just fed up with it.
And the hard part, I think, is to come even that usually it's the case that the speaker elections tend to be a litmus test for party loyalty. That's been true at least since the 20s, according to many of the people who write about this. This could be a pretty ugly fight internally, right? You've got Kevin Roberts, Steve Scalise, maybe Kathy McMorris Rodgers, right, who all come from different wings of the party, and the internal fighting may be something that the Republicans would like to avoid, especially when it's the case that they want to tamp down this sort of sense that the caucus is in disarray.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to give you the big takeaway and what we think is going to happen in the House. So the speaker's position is a pivotal role. It's sort of that third major person in our governmental system. And without having someone who can make the House function, we cannot have a working government. So I think from a structural perspective, having someone that can bring folks together is critical. And to lose someone like Paul Ryan, even if you didn't agree with him ideologically, in temperament, he was sort of an ideal speaker. So it's much more likely, much like we have here in Texas, the next speaker is likely to be a lot more combative and a lot less capable of bringing folks together, assuming it's from the Republican side. On the Democratic side, what we may be seeing is just, this is Paul Ryan telling us that Nancy Pelosi is going to be speaker.
Yeah, could be. I want to start at the top. I think that for Donald Trump, that this is a real blow because Speaker Ryan was one of the major reasons that the tax cut bill passed. And so this is going to be a major blow to his agenda. I think in terms of what the GOP is facing internally, there could be a problem because, again, we're going to have this conflict between the right and the center and the party. If they insist on replacing, if they insist on having a vacated chair, it could get really ugly really fast. I also think that from a political perspective, that like we said, the number of people resigning is at historic, more than double the number of any other year. I read this interesting stat, Jay. This is the most since 1992. And one in eight House seats will have no incumbent on Election Day. That's crazy, right? It could be the Republicans are in serious jeopardy, and it could be in Wisconsin 1, they're in serious jeopardy, right? Paul Ryan stepping aside means a huge opening there. Randy Bryce, the Iron Stash, right, has been raising big money to run against him. He could be one of the first speakers to lose their seat since Tom Foley in 1994. So I think from top to bottom, major implications.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Any questions? Shoot us a tweet with the hashtag PartyPoliticsPod or email us at PartyPoliticsPod@HoustonPublicMedia.org. Thanks to our producer, Edel Hallin, who always lines up a successor. And thanks to our engineer, Todd, Mr. Speaker Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Ruttinghouse. We'll see you next week.